This is Prescription, a work of historical fiction which tells the story of a small child caught up in the events of the bloody massacre of Glencoe. The story looks at how that traumatic experience in early life defined the man he was to become. The four episodes are written and narrated by Gordon Ian MacLeod. It is dedicated to his two grandsons, Hugh and Jamal. Episode 1, Childhood Memories. Everyone can recall what they describe as being their earliest memory. It's not so much that it is their earliest memory, it's simply the first one that they can recall from their distant past. All I can remember is laughter, then screaming. Not a playful screaming, but the type of shrill scream that corresponds to abject terror. I don't know if the laughter immediately preceded the screaming, or if they were the product of different occasions, separated out in time from one another. Whatever the truth, one thing is for certain, and that is, whatever tender age I was at the time, it was not I who was doing the screaming. The screaming can only be described as blood-curdling, similar to the screams I witnessed a few years ago at the end of that ill-fated expedition. There was no accompanying or preceding laughter that time, and there certainly has been none since. As I sit here, alone on this rock, I survey the glen around me as the sun rises, illuminating the encompassing peaks and shining its light in all that is spread out before me. The sound of the roaring river, the dark peat-filled water intermixed with the lifeblood of those who are no longer with us, is the energy which gives it force and momentum as it appears to plunge recklessly through each channel between the rocks which line the river bank. For me, there is a certain irony in the fact that the rock upon which I sit lends itself to being a fine vantage point from which you can view all movements below, but perhaps more importantly, it can be viewed just as easily by others. From it, you can see everything. But it was not so with me. I was found alone on a rock, and today I remain unsure of who I am. I'm not even so sure I believe as strongly in what I stand for as I once did. As I sit here, I can see where it is I came from. I can tell people about my childhood, and just as importantly, they can tell me about mine. But nobody really knows just who I am, and I don't really know either. I think I may have recalled laughter as one of my earliest memories, or as part of my earliest memory, as I was told there was indeed much merriment afoot at that time. Captain Robert Campbell of Glen Lyon had brought two companies of troops to our part of the glen, seeking shelter or quarters for them, so I am told. His men, all 120 of them, were passing through on their way to obtain taxes that were owed to the Crown. Due to overcrowding at the barracks, further north and being early February, it was certainly not the time of year to be without shelter. It was indeed fortunate that one of my brothers, or at least my adopted brother, Alistair Og MacDonald, was married to the captain's niece, Sarah Campbell. This helped ease the suspicions that their presence in the glen may in fact be a hostile act. The elder Alistair, MacIan, the leader of our clan, had reassured us that he had taken the oath of allegiance at Inverary earlier in January to King William and Queen Mary. So as far as he was concerned, we were now under the government's protection. But in hearing the news of the troops' arrival in the glen, he had decreed that all were to take their weapons and hide them immediately in the cairns on the hillsides or in the peat stacks near their cottages, for fear that if they were to be found, they would be confiscated. Fortunately, the government troops' intentions were friendly, and each family took in several of them to shelter. "Traveller, you are welcome here," was the cry that greeted them once their peaceful intent had been established by my other adopted brother John, who was the eldest of the two. Hospitality was the norm in the settlement for any who passed through in peace, and every comfort was afforded them. They were given blankets and enjoyed the warmth of the little peat fires that reeked within each cottage, as some of the smoke climbed its way to the opening in the roof. Although food was not in abundance in the winter months, what little there was in store in each household, and it was shared out liberally with their guests. This mainly comprised of herring and salmon, which were hung from the rafters on the roof, from where they were smoked. There's also some salted beef and venison. Conversely, there was plenty drink, which was shared out generously too. Some of the men met together in the evenings and played cards and backgammon. It was by all accounts a cordial and relaxed affair, far removed from the initial anxiety and suspicion that had engulfed the 200-strong clan on hearing the news of the troops' arrival in the glen. It was indeed fortunate that the captain and my brother were related by marriage, or so everyone had thought. His wife, Sarah MacDonald, was a Campbell. In fact, she was the granddaughter of the mother to Robert Campbell, the captain. There was also a connection to the Stuarts, as his mother's third husband had been married to Stuart of Appin. All had been very still as the early hours of the 13th of February began. Perhaps it was the worst snowfall of the year that muffled all noise and dulled the senses. Who knows? But a beacon was lit in the rock, which was intended to be seen by anyone who was outdoors around this time. However, the intensity of the blizzard occluded it from view for most. That was not to be the only fire that was lit. All the cottages were put to the torch, which was easy to do given their turf roofs. And despite the heavy snow, which had a muffling effect, shrill screams of terror could be heard throughout the glen, interspersed between musket shots. Many fled through the snowdrifts amidst the blizzard. Some were easily found from the trail of blood that trailed onto a white canvas behind them as they tried in great haste to make good their escape. One small boy, having seen his parents struck down by the sword, prayed dearly for his life as he clung to a soldier's leg. But Drummond, a captain of another regiment, ordered that he should not be spared. "Put all to the sword means exactly that," he is reputed to have barked. The slaughter was barbaric, young and old alike. There was no allowance made for women or children. It seemed the wrath of God had fallen upon us. My adopted brothers and mother, I am told, managed, despite the wounds to my mother's hands, to escape with others. Having hidden behind trees at Mule Moor, from where they watched and listened to the bloody events as they unfolded, and powerless to intervene, they struggled across its slopes with their wives and children. From there they journeyed on to Glenlechnamui. Many others, however, simply perished in the snow, or others, having difficulty in distinguishing the pass and sheep trails, had fallen to their deaths in their desperation to escape the butchery. Whether it was by good fortune or by luck, this small party of around 30 escapees reached the head of another glen, Glenetive, where they rested by the river of the same name. My mother had bathed her bloody hand in the river. The cold water served to freeze her hand, where parts of her fingers had been ripped apart by the soldier who had torn the rings from her fingers with his teeth. Men from clans MacIntyre and Stuart of Appin had come across the small party as they headed for Glencoe. They were aware of the movements of a large number of troops towards the Glencoe area and had decided to send an advance party of their own to keep watch and to ensure the government troops were not hell-bent on some mischief. Little did they know when they set out that the great mischief had already befallen the MacDonalds of Glencoe. Taking the men, they led them to safe hiding in a cave near Dalness. Women and children were taken to the homes of the two neighbouring clans. As they went to leave, a MacIntyre, who was to serve as a sentry, had gone to drink from the river. As he turned to leave, he saw a small child sitting on a rock. Gathering him up in his arms, he ran back to the departing party of women and children who were leaving for the safety of the homes which belonged to their rescuers. On asking who the child belonged to, no one seemed to know for sure. Some had suggested the boy had been taken so far along the way by his mother, up the hills when fleeing the slaughter, that having had her clothing ripped from her by soldiers in the barbarous attack, she soon perished to her death in the freezing temperatures. Someone had found and lifted the boy and had carried him here. Whatever the truth, he was well wrapped up, and had undoubtedly been brought safely over the hills by someone in the escape party. Apparently, nobody really knows just who I am, and that is why I don't really know for sure either. It was about a week after the rescue that my mother-to-be found the wounds to her fingers had started to heal. Although she was relieved her sons and grandchildren had escaped, the wounds to her heart remained. They never did heal, the scars remaining for the rest of her life. Having opened the door to the troops at around 5 hours after midnight, she had been violently thrown to the side by one soldier. She had screamed and her husband, McKean, had tried to come through speedily to her aid, only to be gunned down in cold blood by one of the soldiers, who only hours before had been sitting, drinking brandy and playing cards with him. She could not reach him, but knew from the expression on his face he was dead. As she turned away in despair, she felt the sharp teeth biting through to the bone of her fingers, and it took her a moment or two to realise that her assailant was after her rings. So she withdrew her hands sharply, almost causing him to choke as he removed them with his teeth. His gagging had allowed her to escape his clutches and flee out of the cottage entrance. It had been hard telling her tale to those who had come to her rescue, even though a week had now passed since the events of that bloody morning. As the clan chief's wife, special consideration was given to her by her hosts, but her solemn expression and tearfulness, although very understandable given the events which had befallen her and which were now beginning to be reported across the Highlands, were beginning to cause those closest to her some serious concern for her welfare. My brother-to-be, John, had decided that as they had a clan member whom no one seemed to claim as being one of theirs, that his mother might be best occupied with raising him. It was not uncommon anyway for the clan chief to claim a child for his family when twins had been born. As I was found in the rock by one of the McIntyres on that ill-fated day, it was decided I should bear his name. A fitting legacy, given he was captured by the government troops. As he refused to tell his captors where the remaining MacDonalds were being sheltered, he was taken to Inverary, where he was hung, without a single charge being brought against him. I am Donald McIntyre MacDonald, or at least that is what I am now known as. Given my personal history, it also accounts for my distrust of the Hanoverian crown for King William, who went on to be absolved of any blame for what can only be described as a state-sponsored massacre. He had personally signed the orders, both top and bottom. It also explains my strong, unwavering loyalty to the rightful king, King James. Despite her personal loss and the deep chasm it had left in her soul, my mother-to-be took her new role as my adopted mother without hesitation. Despite my earliest memory of laughter followed by those haunting and piercing shrill screams, my childhood was a happy one. Naturally, I was oblivious to the fact that my adopted family were not my blood family, though as in all clans, in all likelihood, we would have been related by virtue of some common ancestor. John, who now became clan chief following the brutal murder of his father, also had a son called Alistair, named after his brother. Alistair and I were the same age, and naturally we grew up alongside one another as we lived in the same household. As time had gone on, we had returned to live in Glencoe, and much of my early childhood was spent roaming in the glen, often with Alistair. We may have been from the chief's household, but it was not until we turned 8 years of age that, just like everyone else, we were given shoes, a bonnet and a hose to wear. I particularly remember the nights when I was younger. These were often spent around the peat fire in the company of other clansmen who recounted the ancient tales of Ossian and Fingal. As I grew older, I also became acutely aware that there were much more serious and intense discussions about affairs of state going on. I suspect that is where I developed my sense of loyalty to the rightful king, King James. There was, rightfully, much anger that the Hanoverian usurper had managed to absolve himself of any responsibility whatsoever for the murder of my fellow clansmen. Indeed, his accession to the throne was all based upon falsehood, the allegation conveniently spread that King James was not a genuine heir to the throne, but was nothing more than a pretender who had been sneaked into the royal bedchamber in a bedpan, created enough doubt to enable King William, with the backing of his Dutch army, to be invited to take the throne in his place. From that one falsehood, the genesis of another was born, which led to his Secretary of State for Scotland, the Master of Stair, who had been the brainchild behind the operation to try and extinguish my fellow clansmen from the face of the earth. They had alleged that MacNeighan had failed to swear his allegiance to the crown, but as Stair knew only too damn fine well, MacNeighan had in fact done so, albeit arriving late by several days. But hard as it was for him, he did swear the oath, and to think he swore it to a Campbell at that. As I look back now at the events of this time and ponder the future, I wonder if other acts and false justifications for mistreating our fellow men will be founded upon similar falsehoods. You can imagine when I turned 13 just how consternation and sheer bloody anger arose on hearing the news that this murderous and evil traitor, not just to the Scottish people but to the entire nation state, having been hell-bent on bringing about a union of parliaments between Scotland and England, had been made an earl. So it was with much lamenting and anger that his desire and machinations to that effect came to pass some 4 years later. It all leaves a bitter taste in the mouth to this day as to how anyone who is responsible for the slaughter of innocent lives can be rewarded for it and promoted. But history has a way of repeating itself. The only blessing I can recall is that he died before it came to pass, so that he did not have the satisfaction of seeing the sunrise on the day when not just the crowns but both parliaments became unified. But I've moved much further on from the account of my childhood and the more pleasant memories where we enjoyed listening to the songs in the evening that were sung around the fire to the haunting melodies that were plucked on the clarsach. It was not uncommon for there to be dancing and much merriment as the night wore on. Needless to say, the younger we were always meant to be sleeping. But Alistair and I knew fine well that once the brandy and ale and the Ushka Behar had been brought out and consumed, that no one seemed to notice or in fact were that bothered any more if we were still up. When the winter nights had passed and spring had come in the glen, Alistair and I, along with boys of our age and older, were usually taken up the river and taught how to fish and to have the best locations pointed out to us where we were likely to find salmon and trout. No one kept the knowledge to themselves of where the best places to fish were, as the more we caught it benefited us all, as food was often shared out. The older men also taught us how to fire a bow and arrow. I was never very good at it, but Alistair was something of a natural. I've seen him hit a moving rabbit from quite some distance. When the summer came around, we were also taught the art of how to fight with swords, though our swords were nothing more than branches off the trees. Alistair may have been a master with his bow and arrow, but I had the upper hand when it came to the use of the sword. In fact, it all got a bit out of hand one day. We were on the hillside after one of our learning sessions, walking home to the cottage when Alistair decided he would come up behind me and surprise me. His cousin, Katrina, who had been visiting from the town of Inverness, had come with us that day. We had been reluctant to have a girl with us, particularly one who was not really used to life on the hills, but we'd relented after my brother John, Alistair's dad, had promised to show us later how to defend ourselves with a round shield called a targe. When Alistair ran at me from behind, screaming at the top of his voice with his sword raised in an attacking pose, naturally I turned around and struck him in the belly with mine. As he was going at some pace, my sword, being no more than a tree branch, broke as it snapped, stabbed and snapped him in the belly. I was going to help him up, but instead, enraged, he pulled me down to the ground and started to strike me. Although I was a much better fighter than he ever was, I did not think it would be wise to inflict further injury on the son of the clan chief. He would, after all, in all likelihood, be clan chief himself one day. So I held him there on the ground, which only seemed to enrage him all the more. I decided to slap him instead until he calmed down. Just at that point, Katrina screamed, and when I turned around in response to look at her, Alistair managed to wrestle himself free from underneath me. "I'll kill you," he screamed through gritted teeth, getting to his feet, and he stormed off with a very reddened face. "What was I meant to do?" I pleaded in all innocence to Katrina. "Maybe you should learn to walk away, Donald," she said in all her maturity of about 10 years of age. She was about 2 years older than us both, and no more was said. Aside from doing my best to ensure that there were no fiery arrows coming my way on the last leg of the journey back to the cottage, it was a solemn return leg. I did wonder what might await me when I got there, but to his credit, Alistair said nothing more about it, and neither had he clipped on me to my mother or his mother either. As my teenage years progressed, we learned not just how to fight with the sword and parry with the targe. We also became used to using the bayaduck or the dirk and how to shoot a pistol. Needless to say, probably because of his fine eye for archery, Alistair was a good shot with the musket. I perhaps was the more proficient with the broadsword or claymore and the targe. Despite our earlier scrap, I would not venture to say who would be the more successful with the dirk were we ever to find ourselves in hand-to-hand combat again. It would be most unlikely, however, as we were at that time as close as brothers, with undivided loyalty to the rightful king, King James, and the cause. Join us for episode 2, when Donald is given a very special commission. Prescription was written, narrated, and produced by Gordon Ian MacLeod. He also performed the music Who Would Na Fecht for Charlie. Prescription by Gordon Ian MacLeod is available as a novel from the Amazon bookstore. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can share the link with others, or make a donation using the donation button, or buying the book from Amazon.